Hello, everyone, and happy 2022. I hope the year's started off well for you. My name is Damon O'Connell with the Warfighting Society, and this is episode 5 of season 3 of Controversy and Clarity. Just two quick admin notes. The podcast reached over 21,000 streams last month, which is a great honor. Thank you to everyone who tunes in. And we're going to try to release podcasts with more regularity this year, with an episode going online about every 2 weeks. So you can expect new episodes on January 21st, February 11th, and February 24th. Now on to our guests for today's conversation. I spoke with Drs. Elizabeth and Robert Bjork. Dr. Elizabeth Bjork is a professor of psychology and senior vice chair in the psychology department at the University of California, Los Angeles, where she has also chaired UCLA's Academic Senate and received the university's Distinguished Teaching Award. Her main area of research has been the study of human memory, particularly the role that inhibitory processes such as those underlying goal-directed forgetting and memory updating play in creating an adaptive human memory system. A focus of her recent research, supported by the James S. McDonnell Foundation, has been the study of how principles of learning discovered in the laboratory can be applied to enhance instructional practices and self-directed learning. One theme of research is how best to use desirable difficulties, which we talk about at length in the episode, things like testing, particularly multiple choice testing, to enhance not only the learning of the explicitly tested information, but also of related information, and additionally, how to use testing to potentiate the initial study and learning of both these types of information. She's an elected member of the Society of Experimental Psychologists, a fellow of the Association for Psychological Science, and has served on editorial boards and review panels for the National Institute of Mental Health. Most recently, with her husband, Robert Bjork, she is a joint recipient of the James McKean Cattell Fellow Award, given by the Association for Psychological Science, in recognition of a lifetime of outstanding contributions and research addressing a critical problem in society at large. Robert Bjork is a distinguished research professor in the Department of Psychology at UCLA. His research focuses on human learning and memory and on the implications of the science of learning for instruction and training. He has served as editor of Memory and Cognition and Psychological Review, co-editor of Psychological Science in the Public Interest, chair of a National Research Council Committee on Techniques for the Enhancement of Human Performance from 1988 to 1994, and chair of the UCLA Department of Psychology from 2003 to 2010. He is a past president or chair of the American Psychological Society, the Western Psychological Association, the Psychonomic Society, the Council of Editors of the American Psychological Association, and the Council of Graduate Departments of Psychology. Bob is a recipient of numerous awards, including UCLA's Distinguished Teaching Award, the American Psychological Association's Distinguished Scientist Lecturer Award, and the Society of Experimental Psychologists Norman Anderson Lifetime Achievement Award. This was an enlightening conversation for me. I learned a ton. I hope you get something out of it, and I hope to have the Bjorks on again soon. Without further ado, our conversation with Elizabeth and Bob Bjork. Elizabeth, Bob, so great to have you on. I am really, really excited about this conversation. So without further ado, let's jump into it. How would you, or how do you define learning?
Well, do you want me to start with this one, Elizabeth? I mean, it's really a subtle question. It's probably best defined by contrasting it with performance. So what we can measure at any one time is how accurate someone is in answering something, how rapidly they can answer it, and so on. Those are all measures of performance. But those things may not give us a good indication of learning because they're very subject to recency, for example, how recently you've gotten this information. They're also very susceptible to current contextual cues, all the things around you that will kind of cue you to the answer. Learning is best measured at a delay. Can you transfer this knowledge to a new situation? And it's really fundamental because teachers, learners themselves can be very fooled by current performance and believe they've mastered something. Everybody's had the experience during high school and college days of, you know, before an exam, looking at the textbook or their notes and just think they've got that, and then finding out in the exam that they can't access that information.
Right.
Maybe the question's asked differently or something. I don't know what you'd want to add to that, Elizabeth.
Well, your points are the main ones. I would just say that learning is, unfortunately, it's sort of not directly observable by us. So we can't just sort of, do I know this, and answer and get an accurate read on whether you do or not. You've got to delay, maybe change the context in which you're in. So, and then try to recall what it is that you thought that you knew, or take a test on it. But you have to do it after delay, as Bob was said. You have to get rid of the presence of all those current cues that were supporting your performance and making you think you knew this and understood it, because they're not going to be there necessarily in the future when you need this information again. And you also want to learn things in such a way that not only you can just verbatimly regurgitate that information, you want to know that information in a way that allows you to apply it to different contexts where it's related. And that's another thing that you can't know other than by putting yourself in such situations and then seeing whether or not you can now recall it in this situation. Or I think we talk about the problem with so much math instruction right now is that it's very blocked, and you teach students a particular formula, say the Pythagorean theorem, and where it's useful and valuable to you, and how you can solve certain problems with it. And then you have to practice them over and over and over again. And even if you change the context of the problem just a little bit, as long as you're just doing it over and over again, so they know, oh, okay, this, I need to apply the Pythagorean theorem. I need to apply the path. They don't have to make that decision on their own. That's information that's provided to them.
Right.
They can get very deceived and think they really understand this problem and this idea. But then later on, if they are presented with a new situation where it doesn't say right at the top, solve this with the Pythagorean theorem, and they have to figure out, is this an appropriate context for me to apply that theorem?
Right.
And that's what massing or blocking, it robs them of the ability to do that or to have experience with that particular challenge. So kind of getting ahead of ourselves, but that's of course one of the desirable difficulties that you need to institute, have people come up with retrieving things in different contexts, retrieving them after delay. That's the only way you can really find out, do I really know this at a sort of deep and flexible level?
Right. It sounds like, you know, for us to know that learning has occurred, we need to have that delay. We need to put the learners in a different environment under a different context. If you're testing them under the same conditions, or maybe even in the same space, you know, the same location in which they first learn the skill or that knowledge, you're going to get, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're going to get an inaccurate reading of how much the learners actually know. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
It's fair to say. And maybe what we're talking about, there may be no place that it's more important than in the military.
Yeah.
Because almost by definition, you can do whatever you can think of in training, but you won't produce exactly the emotional environment, all of those contextual cues. So constructing training so we'll transfer to actual military combat is really very important. Another thing that factors into this is when we give talks, we often will, instead of talking about testing, which for a combination of reasons has become kind of a bad word in U.S. education, we'll talk about the critical role of retrieval practice. That is, you must, to know whether you can do something, practice the retrieval process. It'll be much more informative to whether you understand or know something than simply reading that material again.
Right.
And also retrieval practice, we won't get too complicated here. When you retrieve something, you not only make that stronger and more retrievable, you make things in competition with it. That is, wrong ideas, say, less recallable. So when we've given talks to general audiences, we many times had to switch to the incredible importance of retrieval practice. But it really does translate to the importance of testing as part of your pedagogy and education. People are so wedded to the idea that testing is assessment that we often lose track of just this great power of testing as in part of the education and practice and so on.
The problem with maybe saying you need to do retrieval practice as opposed to restudying over and over again is that it can be discouraging to people who are trying to learn, because they might fail over and over again. And so one thing I think as a teacher we can do is use a procedure that Bob and I refer to as expanding retrieval practice. So you want to have that first attempt to retrieve something that they've been studying pretty close to when they first learned about it, so that they're likely to be successful. And then you can, and then as Bob said, that makes what they retrieve more retrievable in the future. Mm-hmm. So now you can wait a little bit longer and have them retrieve it again. And if you can do this in slightly different contexts, that's even better. But you can structure it in such a way that they don't get discouraged, because they're continually at least being able to retrieve something.
Right.
And then you can give them feedback. And so if you keep expanding, we had a good friend who was, when we were on sabbatical at Dartmouth College, he was a violinist. And unbeknownst to us, he had started incorporating expanding retrieval practice in his practicing of the violin. And the advantage of that is, since you're putting these intervals between one retrieval practice and the second retrieval pass and the third retrieval and the fourth, he could use that space to practice other pieces. Mm. And so he felt like he had not only really expanded his repertoire, but he knew he was better in terms of his playing of the same piece, because groups that used to not invite him to play with them were now starting to invite him to play with them. Yeah. So we felt that was very reinforcing to have him just, hey, I'm going to try this on my own and have success with it.
You know, we're talking about learning. We're talking about retrieval practice. There's another concept in here that plays a large role, and that's forgetting. Could you talk about the link between learning, forgetting, and retrieval practice?
Well, we've written a couple things with titles like Forgetting as the Friend of Learning. And that's to try to emphasize that many of the same conditions that produce forgetting, changing the environmental context, increasing the delay until you go back to something, are associated with forgetting. They're also the very same things that enhance learning if the material is practiced or restudied. So, I mean, the spacing effect, which has been known for over 100 years, that you'll remember something better long term if you space the study opportunities apart rather than mass them together. It's a super example, because if you study something and then you increase the delay to when you test it, you'll recall less of it. That's just the retention curve.
Right.
But if you don't test, but you restudy instead, then at a long delay, you're better. So even though this delay till you restudy produces forgetting, it then enhances learning. And so also there's analogous things with context change, for example. So if you study something in one place, you'll tend to recall it better when you're back in that setting. But if it's restudied, then you are better long-term if you study it again in a new location. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So a number of these things that produce forgetting are also the very things that will enhance long-term learning. So that's the sort of idea behind forgetting as a friend, not the enemy of learning.
Part of what I find so interesting here is the counterintuitive nature of some of these ideas, these concepts, and actually brings me to my next question. And that's, you know, a lot of your research reminds us that as humans, we're typically pretty awful predictors of what we know and don't know, how well we think we'll perform versus our actual performance, how well, I think, as we mentioned earlier, our current performance is a good indicator of our actual learning. Why is this the case? Why are we so good at self-deception, and what are the implications for the classroom?
Well, maybe I can jump in first and then Elizabeth can follow. I mean, it's for reasons we've never fully understood, but are kind of intuitive. People tend to think of themselves as working something like a recording apparatus, you know, that your instructor or the textbook is to present something to you and you're to try to sort of record it in your brain. But in just about every way you can think about it, that is wrong, that it doesn't work that way. You learn new information by linking it up with things you already know. That's what's critical.
So the association.
To get it in stored in memory and so on. And then to make it recallable, it's crucial that it gets, you know, played out, that it gets retrieved. I mean, you don't, in a recording device, when you play it, you don't change its format on the video disc or whatever it's on.
Right.
But with human memory, when we, quote, play something, when we recall it, it changes the system in mostly adaptive ways. That is, it makes the correct information, provided that's what we're recalling, more recallable. Things in competition with it, less recallable. It also has the property that things most accessible in your memory tend to be the more recent things you recall.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, what Elizabeth and I have called updating of human memory is sort of crucial. Lots of evidence shows that the capacity of human memory is essentially unlimited. You can talk about as many billions of bits of information as you want. Wow. And it looks like it's almost unlimited. On the other hand, you don't want everything available that's in your memory. I mean, if I ask you something like your current address, your current phone number, or something like that, if you work like some computer routines would do, you'd come up with a list that all were addresses or phone numbers you've had.
Yeah.
And then you'd go through a decision process to try to see which is the current one.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens in human memory is, as we use new information, a new phone number, new address, new procedure of some kind, gradually it becomes more accessible and things in competition with it become less accessible. They don't leave memory though. They're just kind of sitting there. If they need to be relearned, they can be relearned very efficiently and in a fraction of the original time. So it's really a subtle system, a very effective system, even though it causes us frustrations at times, but it works in very different ways than anything like a standard recording device.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one thing I'd probably just add to that is this idea that recall is very cue dependent. So things can be in your memory, but you just can't access them with the cues that are currently available to you. Doesn't mean you've forgotten them in the sense that they're just, you know, faded away or
like discarded,
in the sand, they've been washed away. They're still there, but it's just that right now you don't have the cues present that allow you to access that information. And that's one of the reasons why we say, you know, learning a different context is helpful, because then your memories don't become highly contextualized. They don't get fixed to that particular, and I think in the military, as Bob was saying, it's very important because things are not going to stay constant. You're in different kinds of terrain. You've got different kinds of things available to you or not available to you.
Right.
But you want to be able to recall, what's the best thing for me to do right now in this situation? So you want a lot of different kinds of cues to be able to help you access that information.
So, you know, partly what I'm hearing from you two is that you want variety, you want diversity as far as the conditions under which people are both learning and applying what they've learned, you know, whether it's knowledge or skills. Because, you know, as you pointed out, particularly in the military, you don't always know where you're going. You don't always know what the mission set will be until you get there. You may not know what assets are available to you or not available to you. Change is a constant, and uncertainty, friction. These are things that, you know, Marines and soldiers and other service members will be aware of.
Yeah, and it's very important in things like sports.
Sure.
Where from one game to another, situations are going to really change, even within a game.
Right.
Like we talked with the coaching group for our football, and we said, and one of the things that, I guess it was the defensive coordinator said, do you mean, now I have these three tackles that I like to teach my players, and when I have these stations, and I set them up, and I have them do 16 of this kind of a tackle. And then they go to the next station and do 16 of this kind of a tackle. and then go to another station and do 16 of the third kind of tackle. Mm-hmm. Are you telling me I should have them like do one or two at this one and then switch to another one and do one or two of that one and do the same number of tackles right. during a practice session, but mix them up? And we said, yes,
that's exactly what
So I think it's like, a lot of times people are instructors are very receptive to these ideas. It's just, they haven't thought of them themselves, because this idea of blocking, it makes you look like you're in drilling. It makes you look like you're a very efficient, organized instructor. You have people going around different places and mixing it up. Maybe it looks like you're kind of disorganized. Mm-hmm. The other thing too, I think, is that this concept of what we call, people refer to as muscle memory.
It's
fortunate that that's so strongly embedded in lore about how you should practice skills, because it doesn't exist. I mean, your muscles do not have the memory in them of what you're supposed to do. All of that is in your brain. Mm-hmm. And so, Bob, what's that example of you have people, you know, sign their signature, and then using just, you know, on a piece of paper, now you make them walk up to a board and say, okay, now do your signature again. And now they write it in great big letters. They don't involve any of the same muscles that they were using mm-hmm. when they were writing their signature on this piece of paper. And yet it looks exactly the same. I mean, it's bigger, it's enlarged, but it is exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can superimpose them. So, I mean, when you're on a big backboard, you have to actually immobilize the hand muscles, and it goes to a whole completely different set of muscles.
Interesting.
But then the signature looks just the same. And there are other examples like that too. But the muscle memory idea can lead you to do non-optimal practice. You know,
this isn't to say you shouldn't train people, but so they develop, you know, you can develop the right kind of muscle growth and whatever. Right. But that's not where the information on how to perform this task is. It's not, you know, it's one of the problems with strokes and things. It's your brain that is no longer communicating to your body what to do and how to do it.
Interesting. Okay.
We've had quite a bit of collaboration with a soccer coach in England, Lee Waddington, who's extraordinarily innovative, and he's led a bunch of youth soccer programs mm-hmm. in England where the very promising young players enter special training programs. And we had told him about variability, change, and so on. And then he did some things very innovative in contrast to the standard things, which you may have the kids all lined up to try penalty kicks mm-hmm. or to be on the sideline to throw the ball in different ways.
Right.
He had set up these stations, but had the kids jump around rather than giving the mass practice, with really good results. And the thing we didn't anticipate is he said the kids started arriving earlier and so on for the practice, because from their standpoint, it was much more interesting practice experience.
Yeah.
Right? A little bit more of like a game-like thing. And he's come up with things that are so innovative that we wouldn't have thought of them, given we don't know if all his background in soccer coaching.
Right.
But it's wonderful examples of trying to include desirable difficulties in training of sports skills, or as training would apply, for example, in the Marines or other military contexts.
No, that's fascinating. And yeah, absolutely, as application.
When you're trying to learn a skill that is very constant in some ways, like making a free throw.
Mm-hmm.
You're always going to be doing it for more or less the same distance. The height of the basket is always the same.
Right.
The ball is always the same. But even there, now we haven't seen an experiment actually do this, but we feel pretty confident from other work that if you have people practice making the free throw from different distances rather than from always at, I guess it's 15 feet is the standard, you would probably make them better, and particularly help people who get you know, frozen, and they're a great basketball player, except they just, you know, can't make a free throw.
Right.
And there's actually some work at a park with little kids throwing beanbags. And one group never was allowed to practice at what was going to be the ultimate target when they had to take the final test on this. They tossed the beanbag at 4 feet and 2 feet, but never at 3 feet, which was going to be the actual target. Mm-hmm. And whereas another group always did all their practicing at the eventual criterion target. And then when they came back several weeks later to test these little kids again, it was the group that had never thrown it to 3 feet that was actually the better, throwing it now to 3 feet, than the ones that had done all their practice. And so one explanation for that is that what you're learning is you're learning a program, a motor program. Mm-hmm. And what those kids learned was how you were learning the program, and then you were just learning to fit in these different parameters. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the close one, this is the far one, targets. And whereas the other people were just practicing that one very specific distance, and it didn't make them better at that specific distance than the one who had had the varied practice, the groups that had had the varied practice. So I think, Bob, you once suggested that when Shaquille O'Neal was having so many problems making free throws, defensive teams would develop into this, what was the hack the shack defense?
Yeah.
And because they knew that they could foul him over and over again, he wouldn't make the free throw. And Bob suggested that they should practice him, you know, at 14 feet and 16 feet and have him practice those rather than always at 15 feet and see if that helped. But
yeah, I was thinking of sending a letter to the Lakers, and I never did that. But what's funny is they ended up quoted with that suggestion in a Time magazine article that they just practiced at 14 and 16.
Actually tried it because he remained.
But in addition to the children's experiment that Elizabeth mentioned, which was kind of a groundbreaking thing a lot of years ago, there have been follow-up studies with golf, for example, showing that players practicing, let's say, pitch shots, they want to hit them well at 50 yards, mm-hmm. that they will do better practicing a mixture of 40 and 60 than they will all their practice at 50.
Interesting.
And so it's been extended to other sports. But now that I mentioned golf, at one point I had made some arguments about people doing all the wrong things on driving ranges. And National Public Radio arranged to interview myself and a colleague who specialized in motor skills at a driving range that's close to the Los Angeles airport. Hmm. And the idea was, we had claimed people do everything wrong on the range, and to be there and just film people and have us comment. But it's almost like these people were, you know, someone might question whether they were
legitimate because
they were so much illustrating what we talked about. Namely, they would hit the same club over and over again, often with only a few seconds delay between, and then line themselves up perfectly with the lines on the mat, sort of not really pick a target out on the range. That is one thing you'd like to do, is not just pick things that are all lined up with the mat on the range. You'd like to pick a shorter target, a longer target, one to the right, one to the left, all of those, introduce all that variation. But instead, they'd hit the same club over and over again. And of course, there will never be an opportunity to do that in a round of golf.
Right.
You know, I mean, it changes dramatically. This next shot was with a different club, a different distance, probably not on a level lie. And so basically, this practice performance is completely misleading. So, and you will hear golfers say over and over again, I just can't believe I was hitting the ball so well on the range yesterday or this morning, and I get out here, I can't hit any of these shots. So it really are our intuitions, as we've said multiple times, really sort of mislead us. And the whole idea of introducing difficulties into practice is something that just doesn't sort of enter most people's minds. But in motor skills, people tend to be much more receptive, actually, in our experience. Elizabeth mentioned the UCLA football coaches being very receptive. And we found, too, in other contexts, I've given talks for the Professional Golfers Association and so on. And people are quite receptive. They're very learning long-term performance-oriented in skills. How will our team do in this away game next week? How will I perform when it matters? But that doesn't seem to be the case for students in college and other environments often. It's not when it really matters. It's like, I've got this quiz at the end of this class, or I've got something that becomes the focus.
Right. Everything's very near term, right? What's right in front of me. Yeah.
That really, in some ways, makes students less receptive to some of these principles because they don't have their eye on long-term performance. Now, we've collaborated with a really impressive instructor in kind of middle school mathematics in England, Will Emeny, who's introduced wonderful things as far as implementing desirable difficulties. Yeah. But just an interesting kind of cross-cultural thing to mention is he was able to introduce things there because the critical thing is how well his students do on the end of the year exams, on a long-term exam.
Right.
And anything that will make the class come out better for that, instructors get some freedom to introduce. Whereas in the United States, it tends to be much more of a kind of short-term performance criteria. And I think, Elizabeth, you were about to add something to that.
Well, I was going to add, I think one difference between trainers, people working with people, instructors trying to help people learn motor skills, is that they can very, part of it is what Bob said, they're interested in future performance, but I think they all can also see how to apply these desirable difficulties. Okay, they won't have people just make the same shot over and over again, or they'll set different targets and it's harder, I think, with text material and, you know, formal educational material to figure out sometimes how to incorporate desirable difficulties. But with respect to the other thing, as Bob mentioned about trainers, I think given that you're involved in military instruction, mm-hmm. marksmanship, it seems to me, is a place where this would be very applicable.
Yeah.
Because again, out in the real world, when there's a time that you actually have to use your weapons, and it's not going to be targets that are exactly where you were practicing. They're going to be in different spots. They're going to be higher or lower. And so varying the practice rather than having just somebody, you know, assume a particular position and aim at a target that's exactly the same and at a certain distance away from them and shoot at that over and over again. So, it's largely just a waste of time in terms of what your performance is going to need to be at critical moments, what the long-term goal of your practice is.
And some of what Lee Waddington has done in soccer made me think back to military training that we observed when I was chairing the National Academy Committee on Techniques to Enhance Human Performance. That was funded by the U.S. Army. When you visit bases, you would see, for example, a line of the soldiers, others in training, at a given station waiting to take their turn at whatever it was. And again, it's somewhat analogous to the kind of soccer thing. That's a lot of wasted time in addition to being completely blocked practice.
Right.
And there ought to be a way that people are moving around. Targets shouldn't be at the same distance and so on. But it's funny how prevalent this is. Elizabeth and I were asked to visit the Cleveland Indians training camp outside of Phoenix, their winter training. And it's an amazing facility in terms of everything available, and I think it was 6 different regulation baseball fields that surrounded this and just every kind of facility. But a lot of the good things were kind of nullified in some ways by players' preferences. So for example, just one example is they had a whole row of these pitching machines so batter could go in a cage and practice. And these players would set the machine to throw like strike after strike at a certain speed.
Right.
And then when we made comments about the importance of variability and so on, they would say, well, I'm just want to work on my swing and not have to, but I just want to work on my swing and not have to worry about whether the ball's, whether it's a strike or a ball or fast or slow.
Right.
And if you just think about it a moment, that's so silly. It's practice that's not going to course. You create a situation you'll never experience in an actual game. Even at that level of elite athletes like that, they can get dominated by current performance. I want to really hit this ball, so I make it easy on myself.
It's self-deceptive and counterproductive. And this has absolute application to the military, where lives are at stake, which is really concerning, right? That how much blocked practice, mass practice we see, how much training or testing of someone's knowledge or skills will occur in the same conditions in which those knowledge and skills were learned. The worlds and the situations that, Marine soldiers, whoever, are going to experience is not set up for their convenience. It's not set up to replicate those same sort of conditions.
Right, right.
I mean, when you think about it, that's terrifying. This is a matter of national security, I think, quite frankly.
A big problem in medicine. We talked with a surgeon here, and he was talking about how even interns are trained, at least through medical practice, or medical school, they're trained on a very fixed situation. Here's how you perform a bypass, whatever it is. And they're working on models that are always the same and so forth. And then the resident gets into an actual operating situation. And you're looking now at a real life human being, and it looks so different than your model. And he just said that they just have these residents just like panicking. What is this? I've never seen anything like this before. And, again, he thinks a lot of it is just that they're trained on just their content is held exactly the same. They're trained on the very same model over and over again. And then when they're put in a different, even slightly different situation, all that experience that doesn't apply, doesn't help them to do what's necessary now.
Right.
And one thing that applies to both military training and this medical training is simulation is actually quite powerful. As you probably know better than we would, when there have been big simulations of combat and so on, soldiers, military people will make a lot of the same mistakes that they will make an actual combat. There's something about the human mind that you get caught up and feel a lot of the same. So simulations can be very important. And at one point, we talked to a group of the leadership of American anesthesiologists on what to do with patients and so on, what procedures to follow. And one thing that kind of amazed us, they were looking at one thing, which was having people answer questions, patient so-and-so, age something with this kind of pre-existing condition, comes in complaining of this, which of the following things do you do? Just almost like multiple choice.
Right.
But the interesting wrinkle, and they never pushed this as far as they should have, in my opinion, is when you said you would do one of these things, then you actually saw a next thing. For example, I was just wanted to experience this, so I'm in there, and I choose something, and now, I forget exactly, but it was like, now the patient's heart rate is up, some other bad indicator, and then it was a question of, what do I do next?
Yeah.
And I was really just so caught up with just anxiety, whatever. And here, there wasn't any reason I should know, but just the notion that this hypothetical person was relying on me. So there's a lot of power in simulations and successive questions of that kind.
Yeah.
that, okay, you chose that, but now we're vulnerable on this flank.
Right, right. The situation evolves, right?
I don't want to go on too long, but this reminds us when we visited the National Training Center out in the California desert, where the big tank units and so on are trained, and they're trained against, this is all developed as part of what I think of as a man, let's see, I wrote down his name. Paul Gorman, who is a general, is kind
General Gorman.
Very regarded as kind of a genius, and I really think he was, but he was the mastermind behind this, and he set that thing up to go against a lot of principles in the military. Like there's expressions like, we do it right the first time, or we don't practice our mistakes, or things like that. And
right.
he set up those, so these units would come in and they'd play, at the time it was set up, they would play these big simulations out in the desert of tank combats and so on, where I won't go into all the details, but some very sophisticated things would put your tank out of commission or soldiers and so on. Right. But one of the things he did was to have what they were called after action reports, and these special vehicles would go out there. They could open up almost like a little theater, and then everybody involved would come in and analyze what had happened. Yeah. And one of his wrinkles was, within that little context, rank didn't matter. Mm-hmm. Person could say, well, why would you send my tank up there when you knew? And then as soon as they were out of that context, it was back to yes or no sir kind of military right. protocols. But right. he did so many innovative things there, incorporating what, you know, we would now call desirable difficulties and other innovations.
Yeah,
but it was very different, you know, than what's often in the military, this whole, we don't practice our mistakes, we do things the right. And then you would know more of these expressions than we would. You know, we do it right the first time and so on. And it was very successful training. Sorry, Elizabeth, I think you want to say something.
A wrong decision is better than no decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, these are all expressions I've heard at different points.
And about the simulations, I think simulations are great training devices, but they need to incorporate this contextual variation. They shouldn't always be the same. And I think that's one thing that was happening in the enterprises that you were talking about, Bob. They were going out and they were facing an enemy that might come over different hills or different, rather than just going through the same simulation over again. And I think you said that was a problem with the nuclear training program, is they spent huge amounts of money trying to make the simulations absolutely veridical. And really, it was would have been better if they changed things up a little bit. What you're trying to learn is, in this situation, I want to make sure I decrease the pressure rather than, oh, I turn the knob, the bright red knob, in a certain direction. And I think you felt like you tried to help them with that in the nuclear training thing there that you...
In the nuclear training center, yeah, they were, yeah, amazing how many things they were following that just inconsistent with research. I mean, everything there was filmed, and you could be eliminated from the training program if you raised your hand and gave a wrong answer to something, you know, which is exactly what you need in a class, is somebody to come up with, you know, we struggle to get our students to be sure to speak up, answer, and so on. And one student coming up with a wrong answer can just upgrade your instruction and realize that you may have been the source of that.
Right.
And but there you could be eliminated from the training program. There were many other problems too, of constant conditions on. You could be eliminated from the training it was like a legalistic thing. Mm. You had this record of this person having this confusion, and you didn't eliminate them. And now there's an incident somewhere. And so it just fed back in this kind of awful way. And when they tried some things, it was pretty amazing. For example, one thing we had mentioned was, I won't be able to tell you the difference, but there's in that area of New England, I think there are three different actual reactors in New England somewhere, but then this big simulator building where they can be in something just like the control room, exactly like it. And they can program this to be able to behave the way it would actually behave. And it's just amazing how people were supposed to do this verbatim compliance, follow exactly a certain procedure, turning pages. But then there was something new. There'd never been a combination before of something overheating somewhere and some weather condition or something like that. Just, you know, what do you do? And I had mentioned once to them that maybe if people did training, there's two types of reactors, a pressure, a boiling water, as something else. Mm-hmm. And maybe if they experienced both, they would get some more general understanding. And this instructor actually had them do that. And there wasn't any kind of rigorous test, but a lot of the interviews to these people said, I never realized that was the function of this thing, because now something was accomplished in some other way in a boiling water reactor and so on. And even something as simple as spacing, they had like a 2-week training thing that they did as one intense block. And at one point we just said, well, what if you do week one and then have them do a lot of other stuff and then you come back and do week two? And that was remarkable, the effects of that. Particularly, actually, not just based on later test scores, but the instructors, what we didn't anticipate is they came back and said how much this had helped them with their teaching, because now they could see a couple weeks later what had sort of lasted, so to speak, in terms of what they did with what hadn't. And anyway, that's a long story, but a lot of these principles really, they go across, not just military settings, but other settings.
Your comments made me think, Bob, that that might be one positive outcome of all the remote instruction that we've had to start doing here. A way a lot of these training programs have worked in the past, whether you're trying to get your anesthesiologist up to speed or you're refreshed or whatever, you bring them out to a conference, you cram all this training into them during one day, and then you send them home, or maybe you keep them there 2 days. But with this remote instruction, you could introduce some of these spacings, and because you wouldn't be flying people to a particular destination to get their training, you could be, you know, they could hook up for an 30 minutes today, and then 30 minutes next week, and so forth, and complete their training or their refresher course or whatever it is, in that kind of way. So that might be one. I don't think people would be so averse to that. I think people have learned to sort of appreciate being able to have meetings and so forth without all the expense of traveling and stuff like that, and still get, you know, something out of it.
There's so much great stuff here, I think, to unpack. I'll focus on one thing, and that's, you know, the value of simulations. And this actually relates directly to the work that I do, at least much of the work I do with the Marine Corps, and that's using things like decision forcing cases or tactical decision games or war games, and that these, especially if you employ a variety of these things, you do teach them in different contexts. Maybe we'll do a decision forcing case in the classroom today, but then tomorrow I'm going to take you to the actual grounds of the battle. And it just, I mean, hearing you say all this just seems to really make your research with what we're doing with these exercises click and make sense. And variety is, it sounds like it's very important. I'm thinking, for instance, if we're trying to train and educate Marine squad leaders in combat operations, you know, we shouldn't give them the same situation again and again. We should give them a variety of situations in a variety of terrain. In some situations, they have more Marines than they typically have. In other situations, they have less. In some situations, they have their, you know, official weapons loadout. In others, they have less, or they have different, or they're working with a partner or allied force. What I'm describing here, does that go along with the research and the sorts of things that you guys are proposing as far as how to properly? Yeah.
It definitely does. And it takes the kind of understanding you have in the domain you've been working, or the understanding a teacher would have teaching something, or military. There needs to be a kind of partnership between researchers like us and people, because we are often asked questions about what would we recommend, where we haven't been in the exact situation enough to know how should you or how could you introduce variability or retrieval mm-hmm. practice. Mm-hmm. And in interactions with people doing sports training, military, some school teachers, they've had insights how to do that in actual practice that I think we wouldn't have thought about, because we don't quite, I mean, we know the college environment and we know what we might have been through in our own high schools or something.
Right.
But exactly what the realities are of the teacher in a classroom, sports training and stuff in some context, so that there's a role here, a very important role, to go back and forth between people that have our kind of expertise and people who really are experts in what is actually happening mm-hmm. in military training mm-hmm. or in the schools or medical schools or whatever.
For us to, until we kind of see exactly what you're faced with, you know, what it is you're trying to teach and train people in, that we can sort of help people say, okay, now we see, here's how you could incorporate expanding retrieval practice,
right.
Or here's how you could incorporate contextual variation. A lot of times we're sort of stuck at more the abstract level. Mm-hmm. You know, here are the things you should be doing, but how you actually install them in a particular training regime, you need more information about exactly, you know, what's being taught.
Sure.
I just wanted to say another role we sometimes play is like with when we went out to the Cleveland Indians to their training camp. In part, one of the reasons they wanted us to come out there was to try to convince these players that there was actually research that showed that these things that they were trying to do were useful, and to try to convince the players that they shouldn't insist, like on these the machines that Bob was talking about, that you set them so that they always deliver the same strike ball, you know, time after time after time. So you know exactly what's coming and,
right.
You know.
This actually leads me to a question that I wanted to ask. And so desirable difficulties, which we can, you know, discuss more in a second, you know, often give the appearance of slowing learning, which many leaders in our military schooling system would treat as a bad thing, right? And something to avoid or correct. And similarly, students taught using desirable difficulties will typically experience drops in performance, right? In that course, you know, within that curriculum, but improve performance in the long term and on the job. So here's my question to you two. And if it, you know, if it stays in the abstract realm, that's completely fine. But how do we get military instructors, facilitators to buy off on apparent slowed learning, decreased performance in their students? I mean, how might you go about that? Where would you start? You already have experience working with different populations, it sounds like. Is there one size fits all approach, which I assume the answer is no, or, you know, would you try to tailor your approach to that military population?
Should I take a stab at this, Bob?
Yeah, sure.
And this is true, and we'll talk about with respect to students. Because we sometimes work with highly accomplished students, honor students, and they're being very successful in what they're doing. And they're afraid of changing to introduce desirable difficulties into their study. They've learned that they like to read the chapter over and over again and highlight it and read it back to back. And that does seem like gives you this feeling that, oh yes, I remember this. I know this. So there's a lot of feedback there. And then if they cram and go off and take their tests, they do well. they haven't experienced the fact that 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now, next term, when they need to have this information for the next course they take, they're not going to remember any of this stuff.
Right.
So you need to somehow set it up so that they realize that this is working. One thing is, as I think we sometimes talk about, is have these low-stake tests, introduce low-stake tests to them. And that way they'll see, okay, I couldn't answer this question a week ago, but now I see what I did wrong. And you know, introduce somehow little successes so that they'll keep going. And really, the school system needs to do more of these comprehensive tests at the end of the term or at the end of the whole school year to get students to learn, I want to learn this for the long term, not just so that I can pass the next quiz. And I think you, in one of your, some of the material that you sent us, you talked about once you take that quiz, students always say, okay, now I'm done with that topic. I can kind of forget it. And other research that we've done is people do give themselves forget instructions. And once they do, they really can inhibit that information and make it hard for them to access it for the future. Mm-hmm. And they love that. Students love that. That's one of the first question you get in class. Are you going to give a cumulative final? And you know, you say yes, your evaluations go way down.
Right.
So, or people drop your course or whatever. And I just think if from high above, people would mandate that we're going to have cumulative tests in all of our courses so that, you know, that's what students learn to expect.
Right.
I think it wouldn't take long for them to realize I am learning more and retaining more now than I used to.
Right.
One of the good things about majors is you do kind of have to, you as you go along, your next class, you realize I can't remember anything from the prerequisite for this course. And so you may go back and review it a little bit. And so you kind of are forced into doing some sort of space study. But all the kind of courses, I think you brought this up, is it a waste of time to even go to undergraduate school? That all those other courses that I took, you know, so I was a math major, and so I got experienced with that, you know, one course builds on another course. But all the other courses I was taking, like in humanities and contemporary society and art history and geology and all those things, I found them very interesting and I really enjoyed taking those courses, but I can't remember. All I can remember now is that I took that course. And right. I used to know, you know, oh, and I see a formation as we're driving out in the country in China. I used to know what caused that. Right. I can't remember.
Right.
So, but so I think somehow, I mean, I think that this is, I would really love to be able to convince administration in some of these schools to incorporate some of these things that make students have to engage in what we call desirable difficulties. And then they would retain so much more, and not just retain it in the sense of remembering the facts, but they'd be able to have, you know, they would improve their conceptual understanding, their ability to apply what they've learned
right.
in new and different ways out in the real world. So.
Yeah, we've argued that it might be a little too strong, but I actually don't think so, that the process of preparing for a cumulative final exam in a course, that last preparation state, which will of course incorporate necessarily things like spacing, retrieval practice, all of those things, that may have more impact on your long-term learning than anything that happened before that.
Wow.
That is, that preparation for cumulative final can be so important in terms of just the way human memory works and making things more recallable on the long term.
Mm-hmm.
That to just give a series of non-cumulative quizzes. Quizzes are just fine, but what a lot of our colleagues are finding, and Elizabeth referred to briefly, is low stakes or no stakes quizzes embedded throughout the course are very effective. And what happens often, just reported by teachers, is when you say you're going to do this, have a little quiz at the start of each lecture, at the end, whatever, no stakes, low stakes, there'll be some groans and maybe some people dropping the course. But then the feedback seems to be pretty universal on final evaluations of the course, that those frequent no stakes quizzes gave them a running kind of measure of how they were doing and what they needed to, how to guide their own studying and so on. And so that's one case where just students experiencing something seem to gain a certain kind of insight. And
it doesn't have to be a lot. I mean, like teachers say, oh, I don't have time. Well, because in my lecture, I have to cover all of these topics. And we need to convince the teachers, well, maybe you should cover one less topic and introduce some of these little quizzes. And then your students are actually going to remember what you taught. Just because you covered them doesn't mean that they're going to remember it. So, and it can be like just two or three questions. And maybe like you say, all right, at the beginning of my next lecture, I'm going to give you two or three questions on what we covered in today's lecture. And usually the lectures are, you know, a couple of days apart, at least, maybe even a week apart. And that, as Bob says, they will all groan, but then they learn to appreciate it, because what it does is it forces them to go back and sort of look through their notes, study for this quiz that's coming up. And it keeps them from doing this, oh, I can forget, that was in Monday's lecture, I can forget that.
Right.
They have to sort of keep reminding themselves and doing kind of a, like a spaced practice. And then it actually makes them, their preparation for the final, much easier, because they've been keeping up. They've been incorporating what went on in the first part of the course into what now they're learning in the middle part of the course. And it's just so much more effective for their learning. And once you've done it, it seems like they learn to appreciate that.
Yeah.
But if you just, you know, teachers will say, if I do that, I'll get horrible ratings. Fortunately, a lot of student evaluations of teachers are just leading to teachers doing bad things.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of what I'm hearing is something that I'll hear from many, many marine instructors. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean, we've been, our training and education system has been producing, you know, effective marine leaders and effective marines. We go and get the job done. I've often taken the controversial view that our marines often succeed in spite of their training and education system, not because of it, and that we fool ourselves by ignoring the tremendous amount of what I think I called in my list of questions to you, data dumping, right? Just the wholesale forgetting or discarding of everything that came in the previous course or the previous annex or block of classes. And that if we implemented some of these changes, one, many of them seem counterintuitive, but at the end of the day, learning will occur. Real learning, right? And this gets to a question I wanted to ask you guys, and that's, you know, could you discuss a little more? I think we touched on it earlier, but, you know, the difference between near versus far transfer of learning, and you know, what is that? How does your work relate to this idea of, you know, learning for the near term versus learning for on the job when you're doing something for real?
Well, basically, near transfer is whether you can transfer this training, knowledge, whatever you have, to a later situation that matches the training situation. That is, can you retain it and transfer it to a situation that just matches the training? Far transfer is, can you transfer this knowledge to a situation where it's relevant, but it's different situation with different cues of various kinds. And, you know, to maximize FAR transfer, you really do have to introduce lots of these kind of manipulations. And I want to go back one step too, to which, you know, what's very relevant to the military and some other situations like police work and so on, is you don't want on-the-job learning. There are a lot of contexts in which you're an apprentice or something like that, and about the best thing you can do is learn sort of on the job, playing some role in that. But in the military, you don't want, or police work or whatever, is very costly to have learning happen then. That is, we talk about the power of mistakes and errors in the learning process, but they're very costly if this is actual police or military or fire accident. And so what that means is some of these things we've been discussing about testing in a varied context and so on become all that much more important in something like military training, police training, and so on, because you don't want people to learn from sort of on-the-job mistakes. They're just too costly.
Yeah, people get killed, people get injured, yeah, expensive things get broken.
So some of these things we talk about, the how to make learning transfer to a new situation, they become all the more important in these contexts where we cannot afford errors being made. And really, there's analysis of errors. I once participated in the nuclear environment in a program that was, it had a funny name, it was like incident analysis. So this was, they collected a bunch of cases where mistakes had been in operating nuclear power reactors. Only a couple of them were serious, like the Three Mile Island thing and stuff. Mostly they didn't end up being very costly, but they were mistakes. It was really interesting analyzing those things, in that the common ingredient by far is something was new in the situation. A weather condition, certain people were out sick and they were being replaced by other people. Something was new and different, and they didn't transfer their knowledge effectively. So they made some mistake. Again, it just becomes very important in military training, some of these other contexts, that the training prepares you to the extent you can for new situations, how to transfer it.
Yeah. And that, you know, I think this ties again right back to the value of simulations. Again, things like decision forcing cases. And what I keyed in on was your comment, Bob, about common ingredient in these mistakes or failures was the introduction or the presence of something new. You know, this sounds like recognition prime decision making. Again, putting it in the context of, let's say, the Marine Corps, they hadn't seen this thing before. It was a novel ingredient. How do I react to this? And, you know, possibly the antidote to that is, again, giving those same people lots of different scenarios, lots of different situations involving a variety of conditions, such that when bad stuff happens in real life, it's not new. I've seen this before, right? They have some sort of mental model that includes this, let's say, rare or unusual circumstance, but it's still there. Is that
yeah, that's accurate? Right. And the other thing that came through in that analysis is, in military and other things, senior level people can become vulnerable to assuming that people in the context of lower level people have been trained and will do the right things.
Interesting.
When a kind of emergency rises, just the notion, well, they've had this training.
Right.
And again, there's a failure to appreciate how difficult transferring training can be to a new situation.
Yeah.
And a lot of common ingredients when in these major accidents, but how did they happen? Often it's the case that somebody did not possess a certain knowledge that you assumed they would. And they did not recognize that this situation differed in some way from something they've experienced before.
So the Marine Corps likes to divide learning into training and education. And training is commonly referred to as preparation for the known, and education preparation for the unknown. What do you think about this division and the definitions for training and education?
Well, the labels are somewhat arbitrary. It's in some ways rephrasing in our language a little bit that we've referred to already, which is what can you do to train people for situations that will have novel features, unanticipated novel features, versus training people for something where you know exactly what the context will be. Mm-hmm. And so it's somewhat a different look at that important information. I don't know if you have something to add to that, Elizabeth.
No, it sounds like exactly that if you in some way know exactly what the situation is, exactly what the cues that will be present are, so that there's a specific formula, a specific routine, a specific process that you can apply, that would be, you'd want to train them on that. Mm-hmm. But almost always we're training people to perform effectively in situations in the future that may or may not be exactly the same mm-hmm. as the one that exists in their training. And so that's where we feel like, you know, all these things like, you know, use simulation, but change it a little bit from one time to the other. Don't just keep practicing the same thing. Contextual variation and introducing spacing and all those, what we call desirable difficulties, can really help with that. They can really help you generalize what you learn in one situation to new situations where they're going to be variables at present that weren't there in the original training.
Yeah.
We should probably add, as we often have to, that when we say desirable difficulties, the word desirable is important there.
Sure.
That is, often people are saying that we're just, say, making things hard on people. But there are individual differences in what level of difficulty will be desirable. So, for example, just consider the power of retrieval practice, the power of producing a procedure and so on. You need to set up the conditions so that it's a difficult but successful process. And so that's going to vary depending on what level of prior training a person's had. So it's not desirable to make things difficult in a way that there's nothing but failure. So we constantly have to emphasize that word desirable is important, and that, among other things, it indicates that training needs to be structured with the learner's background level of knowledge mm-hmm. and current knowledge in place. Mm-hmm. So one of the skills that some teachers have is to kind of know, be able to get a picture of where this given student stands in terms of prior learning, mm-hmm. what they know and what they don't know and so on. And then that can guide what questions are asked and so on. Mm-hmm. It's not just making things hard on people, because motivational issues are very important, and people need to feel some sense of progress, success,
yeah.
just to keep going.
Maybe a different way of expressing is that you want to give people a challenge, but it's not such a great challenge that they have no chance of succeeding.
Mm.
And they don't have to succeed in a perfect way, but just if they succeed a little bit, I think that works well. Because we sometimes talk about games, video games, and the makers of those video games have gotten to be just masters at this, setting the difficulty level
mm-hmm.
at a place where it's challenging, but with a little bit of persistence, the player can have some success.
Right.
And there, difficulty is easily desired by the player, because mm-hmm. they don't want to go back to a level in that game that they've already mastered and that isn't challenging to them at all. Mm-hmm. They want to go to the next level, and they accept the fact that when they first start on that next level, they probably won't be able to succeed as well as they were doing on the previous mm-hmm. level.
Right.
But they know that eventually they're going to get better, and this is the only way to keep getting better and better. And so somehow you want to structure the learning situation such that happens okay, I've mastered this, but now this little thing has changed and I need to know how to deal with it mm-hmm. when this little thing has changed. And let me think, what do I already know that I can apply here? You want people to at least succeed a little bit on the new challenge, mm-hmm. but they don't have to be completely successful for it to still be a very effective learning trial. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you want to give them another chance and maybe change it again just a little bit, or give them some feedback that helps them to see, you know, well, now, what, did you remember when you did this, that, and the other thing? Do you think that might work here? Why don't you try that? You know, and so forth. So, yeah, it's just so important that you don't just come up with some difficulty that has nothing to do with helping them to retrieve more mm-hmm. or helping them to generalize their understand the, all the various different kind of contexts in which this might apply.
Right.
Just like we've had people say that, you know, put it in little tiny print or jiggle the print up and stuff like that. So it just make it more difficult for people to read. That's not the kind of difficulties that we're talking about.
That just sounds mean.
And also, you know, people are sensitive to progress. So I mentioned before the nuclear training center out in the California desert for tank combat. When units came in there to practice against the so-called Blue Force, which was there stationed there all the time, it was about impossible to beat the Blue Force. But across, I think it was 7 stage combat, so 9 days or something, mm-hmm. people could see this progress. And that was the really rewarding thing. Not that you would defeat the Blue Force, but that you would make progress across, clearly identifiable progress across. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something, too, we sometimes forget is we're sensitive to progress. You know, it happens in athletics and so sure. on. Well, we didn't win, but we were this much better than before. And
some
so
sense
on.
That we're getting better over time
yeah.
and not and plateauing or even
sense
regressing.
Is important, I think.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you if there's one thing, and if I could get one thing from each of you, you'd want U.S. service members to take away from your research on learning and memory and these associated concepts, what would that one thing be?
Well, it might go back a bit to things we kind of discussed at the outset, that what matters is your performance when it matters. And to have an appreciation that your intuitions and even your prior experiences can mislead you. They can lead you as well, because you will have experienced certain things in sports and military other contexts that are instructive. But just the notion that what you want to optimize is performance when it matters, and that doing that requires going against some of your intuitions and coming to appreciate some of what we've called the unique functional architecture of humans as learners. Just to disabuse people that you're going to make anything like a recording device. It's tough to say one thing, but that might be one very important thing.
Mm-hmm. Maybe one other thing would get them to sort of accept being challenged. And if it all seems too easy, it seems it's like it's going too smoothly, that's when you should be a little suspicious that you're not really learning anything mm-hmm. substantial, or you're not really learning in such a way that you're going to be able to remember in the future and apply what you learned to in appropriate new context. Mm-hmm. That so don't get discouraged by difficulty. Look on it as a challenge, but a challenge that you can overcome, as opposed to this notion that a lot of kids, well, if I'm not interested in it, then I don't want to bother learning it. If it's not fun, I don't want to bother learning it. Because there are a lot of things that if you just learn a little bit about them, they become interesting to you.
Right, right.
And so, you know, just have faith that struggling a little bit will have these big payoffs to you in the future. And you shouldn't just take them as, I can't do this.
Mm-hmm. We had a closing line, Elizabeth, in some article about not being deterred by the sense of difficulty and not being reassured by the sense of ease.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, that's the other combination too, that if something's easy now, right now, don't be too reassured by that in terms of how you'll do it. It really matters. And if something's difficult right now, don't be deterred by that one way or another either. I mean, the ultimate would be the kind of thing that can happen with an early life experience where one bad math test early in your schooling makes you think math is not your thing.
Right.
And then you make that a self-fulfilling prophecy by all the decisions you make after that.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough to encapsulate these things in a really concise way, but those are critical points.
There's some quote, I don't know who said this quote, but it was like, what is a really, and I think it's so dated that they only said man, what is the definition of an educated, truly educated man? And it's to have learned and mastered something that they had no interest in.
Hmm.
And I think if we could convince a lot of students that if you just, you know, you stick with it, if you get a little more information, learn a little bit more, this thing that you think is boring or you don't understand or this is not for me could become one of your favorite activities or your favorite things to learn about. Mm-hmm. My personal experience like that for me was when our boys were learning to play basketball. And I had grown up in Oklahoma where football was king and basketball wasn't anything people paid much attention to. So I hadn't really learned about basketball. But I became, Bob was the coach of a team, and I became he made me the statistician. So I had to, you know, record all these different kinds of things that go on in a basketball game, like assists and like defensive rebounds and offensive rebounds. And I can't even remember what all it was, but there were about 10 things I had to record. And what this made me is made me into a big basketball fan. Mm. I decided, okay, there's a lot to this game that I couldn't appreciate before. And now I realize that, you know, there are plays and there are passes and there are all these things that I can now see patterns of passing and so forth that I can see now that I couldn't when I first started watching. And so that's kind of an example. Once you learn, when you learn about something, you may find that you become very interested in it.
Sure. There may be an initial, you know, resistance or some degree of boredom, but if you push through that to the other side, you, like you said, Elizabeth, you may be all about this thing.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth and somebody helping her with this set up this record keeping to then finally have this, you know, there are good things you can do on the court and bad things. You know, there's assists, there's turnovers, there's points, there's this and that. And sort of came up with a thing where you more or less added up people's good things minus the bad things and then accounted for how much of the game they played.
Mm-hmm.
And that led you to kind of a measure of what was your contributions. And it was funny how across some games it changed these kids' attitude, because the kid who scored the most points might have had the most turnovers, no assists, and so on. So on this measure, Elizabeth and this friend came up with, they would come back to look at this and they might be third or fourth on the list.
Wow.
And the kid who had all these assists and rebounds and stuff is first.
Yeah.
And it gradually just started to change their whole, the notion that they got a rebound, if they got an assist, you know.
They started really appreciating guys who probably never made a point, but were very good in terms of, you know, getting rebounds and passing. And
right. They
had really, you know, had 12 assists during the game or something like that.
Right.
And so it really changed the culture of the team. Didn't you think, Bob, they were much
more? Yes, it did. It really changed their you know, the very notion that a rebound, an assist added up as much as the basket did, was made them, a lot of things made them more willing to share the ball, to stop just dribbling. And I had some things to learn and practice when I was coaching kids basketball. And sometimes introducing a difficulty was an incredibly immediate effect. I just mentioned one of those is kids early on in basketball will just start looking at the ball and dribbling. They don't see anything else on the court. And I found out with our team, if I set up a little, split the team into two and had a little scrimmage game, and simply said, if you dribble more than once, it's a turnover to the other side. As you can take a dribble to go to the basket, a dribble to get free, but the second dribble, it turns a turnover to the other team. Mm-hmm. Amazing effect that had. It just, that was, of all the things I tried, that had the most immediate consequence. Now it looked like something more associating real basketball with these kids, rather than some kid looking down at the ball and dribbling. They had to have in mind, where will I pass this? Mm-hmm. Who's open, who's not open? Anyway, that power was an introduction of a difficulty that really was desirable in that particular case.
Yeah. I know we're almost at time. Elizabeth, Bob, this has been a highly enlightening conversation for me. I've learned so much from talking with you, hearing about your experiences. Do you have any parting thoughts or shots for our listeners?
Well, I mean, we tried before, but I think there is a mission of expressing our appreciation. You know, the Marines have a tradition of being first, sometimes having the greatest losses, and it's a special group that you're dealing with. From that standpoint, anything you can find in our research or anything we can say that's helpful is just gratifying to us.
That means a lot. And, you know, we'll continue to share the great research that you and Elizabeth are doing. And yeah, I'd certainly like to continue this conversation and see where our, you know, interests and work intersect and, you know, help as many folks as we can. So again, thank you so much for the conversation. This has been fantastic and really looking forward to sharing it with our audience.
Okay. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.